In 2006, the Bush administration opened what are known as communications management units within federal prisons. The idea was to isolate inmates who were thought to have ties to terrorism-related activities. Joining me now for a look at who's being held in these units and what the conditions are like is Leah Malik. Her article, Gitmo in the Heartland, appears in the March 28th issue of The Nation, and I'm very pleased to welcome her to today's Backstory segment. Hello.
Hi, Leonard. It's good to be back.
Where are these communications management units located, and how much is known about them?
Well, they really are in the heartland. One is in Marion in southern Illinois, and the other is in Terre Haute in Indiana. And the reality is very little is known about them, although they've sort of been known about. You know, there have been whispers about them since late 2006.
Well, the Bush administration announced that they were going to be established, but then opened them during the comment period. So that must have come as a surprise. Why did the Bush administration feel the need to create these units? Weren't other forms of isolation like solitary confinement working perfectly well?
No, they obviously were, but they decided that they wanted to be able to more closely monitor the communications of people that they said had a terrorist link to violence. And they did. According to actually administrative law in the United States, agencies like the Bureau of Prisons do have to subject themselves to a period of comment from the public. It's sort of a way to maintain a kind of transparency in the things that the agency is doing, and also to sort of be able to derive some of the expertise that is available in the public about these kinds of policies. And the Bush administration started to comply with that process, and they did go through this initial, you know, period of commenting, allowing people to submit comments on the policy that they were proposing. But in that time when they should have, you know, when people were expecting that they would post the final rule before they actually enacted it, what they did was they went ahead and opened these units really, secretly, quite, and potentially illegally, which is what a lot of the lawsuits that have been brought against them are alleging.
Well, the ACLU raised objections to the proposal in late 2006.
Right, many groups did, in fact. And I think that might have been one of the reasons that the Bush administration decided to not comply with the process.
Well, how did people... Go ahead.
No, there was quite a pushback.
Well, how did people even learn in February 2007 that the unit had already been opened?
Well, one of the inmates who was an Iraqi-American physician who had been sent to jail for violating the sanctions on Iraq because he was sending medicines to Iraq in a way that the U.S. government felt undermined the sanctions regime. He managed to get a letter out saying a bunch of us were sort of rounded up in the middle of, you know, the night in the different prisons where we were, and we were brought to this place. And he said that just about everybody here is Arab. Everybody there is Muslim American except for one person at the time who wasn't actually also Arab American.
Now, he said that 4 years ago. Is that still the case?
Well, since then, it's kind of interesting. A lot of people started to raise concerns about the makeup of the units, especially when only 6% of the federal prison population is Muslim. And what started to happen then, and this is nothing that the Bureau of Prisons will confirm, but we know this anecdotally, was they started to move in folks who were neither Arab nor Muslim American. And the people within the units used to tell these inmates that they were not really like the inmates that this unit was meant for. They were just there to balance. So they basically bust in, you know, people from a different racial and religious demographic, if you wanted to use analogy from another context, to sort of fix these numbers a little bit.
So you tell the story of Daniel McGowan, who was brought in later.
Exactly.
Why was he in federal prison?
He was in prison for environmental acts related to environmental terrorism. He had pled guilty and actually hadn't been, I'm not mistaken, had not really been convicted of any violent acts, but he was brought in. He was a low security prisoner, which is one step above the lowest, which is minimum security. And he had an exemplary record. He was getting his master's degree at the prison that he was at, and he had been recommended to be moved closer to home at the time. And all of a sudden, he was put into this super restrictive unit at no explanation to him that was really of any kind of substance.
Well, he had engaged in, I guess he did these crimes, two ecologically motivated arsons. Mm-hmm. Some people might not call that eco-terrorism, but that was enough to get him put into the CMU. How did his wife find out that he'd moved there?
You know, basically she was waiting for him to call her on her second anniversary. She was waiting, you know, when you're in federal prison, you have up to about 300 minutes of phone calls a month. So, you know, they spoke daily, you know, every day for a bit for 10 minutes, and it was their anniversary, and she was waiting for him to call her. And it was a month later when she was finally able to speak to him because he sort of disappeared into the Bureau of Prisons system.
Now, did he even know why he was being moved?
Well, according to the procedure, you are given a notification after you arrive that sort of explains to you why you were there. But from the notifications that the lawyers at the Center for Constitutional Rights and the ACLU have been able to see, it's not particularly substantive. It's just sort of a pro forma perfunctory saying that, you know, your communications need to be further looked at based on, and in most cases based on, the underlying crime that you were already convicted for and already sort of serving your sentence, in Daniel's case, you know, in an exemplary fashion somewhere else.
In that letter to the ACLU, that Dr. Raphael Dufour, mm-hmm. 4 years ago, said that, as you pointed out, that most of the people there were Muslim and Arab, and many of them didn't speak English. But aren't the rules of the CMU that you can only have outside contact in English?
Right. Some of them didn't speak English. Most of them actually are Muslim and Arab American. Yes. They, you know, communications can only be in English, and they're very, very restricted. They're, you know, it's established a floor of 15 minutes a week, which would add up to, you know, 90 minutes a month, whereas most people are allowed, you know, more or less unlimited calls. You know, they're only allowed a few hours of visits a month, and there's an absolute ban on contact visits. So they're not allowed, you know, a lot of these people have children, grandchildren, wives. They're not allowed to touch them, and this is sort of really extreme, and there is no real comparison. There's nothing comparable within the federal system.
So if you can't speak English, that means you can't talk, you can't communicate with anybody?
Yeah. It becomes quite difficult.
Or else you have to tell it. I guess the reason they're doing that is they want to know what you're saying.
Right. The conversations are live monitored. But, you know, if you're trying to remain a meaningful parent or a meaningful spouse in your, you know, in your family's life, you know, and you've already been moved out to, you know, most of these folks don't come from Indiana or Illinois, you know, so you've already been moved out in a place where, you know, really imposes quite a hardship to come visit, there's very little chance that you can be a meaningful spouse or parent if you can't speak English, that's for sure. And it's quite a challenge even if you do. And the thing is, it's sort of interesting to know, is that everybody who's sort of involved in penal and rehabilitative processes tells you that one of the most important things for rehabilitation is strong family connections, even while you're incarcerated. And this is not Faisal Shamza that we're talking about. These aren't the most dangerous criminals. A lot of these guys have already been released, are going to be released in the coming years. And sort of we're already, you know, we're breaking down their families in one sense, but we're also sort of, like, as a society, lessening the quality of what their rehabilitation will look like and their successful reintegration. That's something that's sort of recognized by a lot of folks from different sides of the corrective world. And when comments were able to be submitted the second time around with the Obama administration, you know, that was a recurring theme, no matter what end of the political spectrum that people commented on.
We're talking about communications management units on today's Backstory segment with Aaliyah Malik, whose article Gitmo in the Heartland appears in the March 28th issue of The Nation. Research support for the article came from the Investigative Fund at the Nation Institute. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. What are the conditions for prisoners in the CMUs like, as set out by the Bureau of Prison proposal in 2006? Is this just a typical prison setting?
Well, in 2006, it's kind of changed, because the Obama administration, when they came in, they decided to sort of, They've maintained them, and in fact broadened the scope of to whom they, you know, such kinds of regulations can be applied to. So currently, it establishes a floor of how limited the communications can be. But, you know, I think it's informative to compare it to what it's like in regular federal prison, even in the supermax, where people, you know, have up to 32 hours of visit a month. In this case, they have, I think it's it adds up to 3 to 6 hours a month. They have up to 300 minutes of phone calls. These guys get 15 minutes a week, and they have a limit on how many pages of letters, you know, that they can write, and all their communications have to be in English. And what's really particularly devastating for those who have families is the absolute ban on contact visits, because the only people going out there to visit them are their families, and they are not allowed to touch, even though their families are subjected to searches going in and out, as are the inmates themselves. And these aren't people with any sort of proven communications infractions for the most part. Now, when the Obama administration broadened the scope to be applied to folks who have communications infractions, a few people have been, and the BOP will not tell us exactly who's in there. So it's through kind of anecdotal investigation that you can find out. There are one or two folks who are in there for having, you know, for such kinds of communications infractions where they're able to order a hit, let's say, for example, from prison. But for the most part, it's these kinds of people who are, I mean, in Terre Haute, it's 55% Muslim American. In Marion, it's 64% American. And even the ones who have terrorism convictions, a lot of them, the underlying facts are that they gave money to charitable organizations that, through the material support law on terrorism, comes to be defined as terrorist activity, even though they didn't intend violent activities nor supported violent activities, but actually gave money to charity.
Can inmates petition to be taken out of the CMUs?
Sure, there's an internal process, but no one has successfully won such a process.
How much discretion do the wardens have as to communication? Do these men, they're all men,
yes.
are they isolated from each other?
No, from what we understand, inside they're not isolated. You know, they're able to talk to each other, to pray. There's a lot of yoga and Pilates going on. There are a lot of, you know, little education certificates that they can gain.
Well, I'm wondering about the criteria for going to the CMU. You've been talking about this a bit. Mm-hmm. There is the case of Sabri Benkhala, an inmate whose federal judge said that at his trial that he wasn't a terrorist, but he still ended up in a CMU.
Yeah, he still ended up in prison, interestingly enough. No, that's the point. I mean, that's one of the contentions, because there's a major lawsuit that's been filed by the Center for Constitutional Rights against the Department of Justice and the Bureau of Prisons, and that's one of the things that they are alleging, is that there are due process violations in how folks are assigned to these units and whether or not they are given, you know, appropriate kind of notice, appropriate kind of, you know, substantive evidence as to what they have done that would get them in there, what the appeals process looks like. So it's arbitrary and it's capricious. In the case of Daniel, who you brought up, you know, Daniel, right before he got moved, had had an exemplary sort of file review. He had been recommended to be moved, you know, closer to his wife in New York, and the next thing he knew, he was in the CMU, and then he got out of the CMU at one point while I was doing the story, and when I went to Marion over the Thanksgiving holiday, his wife got to see him in general population, but then just like that, he was moved back a few weeks ago, and again, the notice is not substantive in any way. That you can't really challenge it if you don't know what the evidence against you is.
When the Center for Constitutional Rights filed that lawsuit last year, they charged that the CMUs violated the Administrative Procedure Act as well as the First, Fifth, and Eighth Amendments. How did the Obama administration respond?
With a motion to dismiss.
That was it. The First Amendment, because one of the criteria for being put in the unit seems to be religion. The Fifth Amendment, because the inmates were not given the opportunity to petition or appeal their imprisonment in the units. And the Eighth, because they argue it's cruel and unusual punishment.
Well, I mean, of course the government would say that religion is not a criteria, that the criteria can be, you know, I mean, and they have a stated list of what the criteria could be. But in reality, we know that 73% of those in Terre Haute are there because of a terrorist link, and 64% of those in Marion are there for a terrorist link. And then when you start to take those apart, these aren't actually violent offenders. These are people who have been, in many ways, for the most part, prosecuted either on the material support law of terrorism, which means that even if you give money to the charitable side of a group that is somehow affiliated with a terrorist organization like Hamas in Gaza, then you are guilty of supporting terrorism. Or entrapment cases where an FBI informant sort of went in and, you know, put together a plot, and these people were convicted on that. So it was a failure of the entrapment defense. But our most dangerous, you know, terrorist convicts are not in the CMUs. They're in the Supermax.
So what would you propose? Some of these people still committed crimes, or most, I guess, pretty much all of them. Should they just be returned to the general prison population?
Well, I'm not an expert on penal policy, but I did talk to a lot of them. And, you know, people from, you know, really different ends of the field and different sides of the political spectrum say there's a way to evaluate. I mean, you always want your policies to sort of correlate in a logical way to whatever your penological interests are. And I think people within the field would say there seems to be a sort of a breakdown and a dissonance between, you know, the professed goals and the actual policies as they're carried out. Because these aren't the most violent offenders. A lot of them are low and medium security prisoners. These aren't people who've violated any kind of communications regulations within the BOP. So I guess the question would be, is there a way, and there are only about 100 folks total in both of these, can't we review these people and sort of make some kind of determination as to whether the isolation that they have been put in actually keeps us safer and is works towards their rehabilitation and is also, you know, in any way logical?
Elia, we actually have on the line somebody who called in, Andrew Stepanian, who was in the CMU. Okay. Hi, Andrew.
Hi, how are you?
Okay.
Hi, Andy.
Hi, Adam.
You were, what reason were you put into the CMU?
I was charged with a violation of the Animal Enterprise Protection Act, and it's a charge that's analogous to a terrorism count. It was put into legislation in 1992, and after 9/11 was enhanced with terror enhancements. So I was charged for my animal rights activism, nonviolent activism, but for 6.5 months of a 3-year sentence, I was placed in the CMU.
And then when your 3-year sentence was over, they released you?
Yes, actually, I was released to a work release program in Brooklyn, and I started working for a publishing company here in New York.
Now, did you think that the CMU was a worse place to be than in a regular prison?
In all fairness, it cuts both ways. In one sense, in the medium-high security prison where I was prior, I had access to a large yard. And I also taught the educational program there. I taught other prisoners the GED program, and it was an enriching experience for me. I was able to see the open sky and, you know, communicate pretty freely with other inmates and have nice conversations, and also be able to receive visits from my loved ones. But when I got to the CMU, the main things that I noticed was huge racial disparity. Most of the people that were there were either Arab nationals or Muslims, and every case that was there was pretty much a political case, or people that had politics that were either deemed unsavory or unpopular in American politics.
And were you able to develop any kinds of relationships with those people, or did you feel like you were from different worlds?
You know, unfortunately, coming from a radically left background, being put in a situation where some of the only white males that were there were racist offenders, it was kind of hard for me at first to communicate with people because I didn't really want to have any conversations with those folks from racist organizations. But when it came to the Arab nationals and the Muslims, they treated me beyond fair. They actually knew that I was a vegan, and they started reading the ingredients on packages to make sure that I had enough food to eat. They were giving me writing materials, and they were arguing with the case managers there to make sure that I had access to a phone call to let my family know that I was transferred there. They were advocating for me every minute that I was there, and they just kind of looked out for me. They didn't have to do that. I wasn't a member of their community. And all I saw time and time again were just men that loved their families, people that cared deeply for their loved ones, and people that were just regular folks, just like you and I. It's very different, especially being that I saw the news that everybody else saw about some of these men and their cases. They're very high-profile cases. For example, one man is a co-defendant of Jose Padilla's. But when it comes down to the minutiae of this court case, he's charged with breaching neutrality agreements for a charity that he set up in Yugoslavia. It has nothing to do with what most people identify with the Jose Padilla case as a dirty bombing case or as the press releases once stated. In fact, in the case of Jose Padilla, he's not even charged with the dirty bomb charge. That's just what the allegation said in the initial press release.
Andrew, we have to end this segment very soon, but I want to go back to Aliyah with one more question. Do we have any sense whether the Obama administration plans to revisit the policy on CMUs?
Well, they did. I mean, when they came in, they sort of, you know, as one of the experts I talked to said, got caught with their pants down on this. So what they tried to do, I mean, they sort of tried to go back and re-legitimize this because so now they're complying in a sense with the Administrative Procedures Act. They published a new rule, you know, so they're trying to ex post facto kind of make this comply with the law. But the thing is, the rule that they published was much more, you know, had a much broader scope and to whom it could be applied. And again, all the groups submitted their comments, and, you know, the Obama administration has said they will publish a finalized rule this coming October, which means that we have been in this process for almost 2 years, which is grossly irregular, according to the experts. When it comes to something like this. So for now, the Obama administration is clearly maintaining them. And when I asked them if they had conducted any kind of review when they came in of the procedure of the CMUs themselves, or whether or not they were going to review who was there, they declined to answer that.
Aliyah Malik, thank you so much for talking with us. The article Gitmo in the Heartland appears in the March 28th issue of The Nation, and research support. The article came from the Investigative Fund at the Nation Institute. And Andrew Stepanian, thank you so much for calling in.
Yeah, thank you so much. It was a pleasure talking with you guys. Have a great day. ¶¶